Welcome to the first of 3-hour-long panel discussions of the domino effect of quarantine and responses to COVID-19, which I'll be calling the virus because I'm American and I like to shorten things the most effective and dramatic way possible. This is a collaboration between the Building Performance Podcast and Healthy Indoors Magazine. This will be part one, how this pandemic is affecting us. Part two is going to be from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, and that's managing the public health crisis. And part three from 3 to 4 p.m. is going to be practical antivirus measures for buildings. All of this is obviously, since it's coming from us, it's going to be centered around the idea of the fact that we're all kind of indoors and how this is affecting life right now. We already spent 90% of our lives inside, and now it's jacked up to a higher level, especially in homes. So please put any questions or comments you have in the Q&A box that is in your Zoom navigation pane there. Don't use the chat box, that's just for technical stuff. We have an awesome group of experts participating this hour, so let me introduce them before we dive in. First, we have Dr. Michelle Sanborn, a board-certified internal medicine physician who holds a master's degree in public health. She's worked with the U.S. Air Force and Army, and as a hospitalist for civilians, and she's also the doctor I lean on first when my kids have medical emergencies, like I drop them on their heads, because I'm lucky to be her cousin. Michelle, thank you very much for being here.
Hi.
Next, we have healthy building scientist Joe Medosh of Hayward Score. To say Joe has a diverse experience base and interests is a tragic understatement, as you probably have picked up on this little pre-roll. But suffice to say, he's been pushing the envelope with the science of homes for the past 18 years and is a fountain of fresh ideas. He's also a good friend of mine. Joe, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, that'd be me.
That if is you didn't correct. Know. Right. Yeah. Most of what I know now about chemistry, I learned from our next guest. Dr. Delphine Farmer is an environmental chemist who researches both outdoor and indoor atmospheric chemistry and gives incredible explanations of what she discovers as well, which is not normal for scientists. In 2018, she co-led the House Observations of Microbial and Environmental Chemistry Experiment, or HomeChem for short, which is where I was fortunate to first work with her. Delphine, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And last, we have Bob Krell, the esteemed publisher of two magazines central to the scientific home improvement and construction industry, Healthy Indoors Magazine and the Building Performance Journal. For the past 30 years, Bob has been investigating and mitigating indoor environmental issues in residential, commercial, educational, and healthcare facilities throughout the U.S. And as you might have guessed, he's also one of my favorite people. Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
And thank Good you to for be hosting here. This. Yes, thank you for doing all the technical backup.
One housekeeping thing for the viewers out there. You have in the upper right-hand corner of your screen, you have the choice to toggle between speaker view and gallery view. And the speaker view will give you the current speaker at full screen. And gallery view will let you see all of us as the Brady Bunch. So that's an option you have at home. So just wanted to point that out to people.
Excellent, Sorry. Thank you. So if you don't know me, I'm the amateur in this group. I'm Corbett Lunsford. I'll be moderating this first part of the series. My 12-year background in testing the invisible dynamics of physics, chemistry, and microbiology in homes is how I got interested in this. I also co-host Home Diagnosis, which is the first television series about the science of homes, which airs on PBS. So, to set the stage for this hour's conversation, we'll focus on the logistics of what's happening right now worldwide, the game theory of it, if you will. We are now spending almost 100% of our time in our homes. Don't forget to take walks, everybody. We did a couple yesterday. We're the only people on the street. If we were guinea pigs of indoor chemistry before this, how much more so now that we're all locked in? So how many people that you can think of have truly safe homes where there are none of the health risks that many of the building professionals listening in see and test for every day? I can picture lots of unhealthy homes that I'm having nightmares about people being trapped in all day long. So the three high-level things that we can do to keep our homes healthy where we're trapped right now, which we'll dive into in detail in part three, are number one, don't bring bad stuff home. And that includes the virus. Number two, keep it dry. And number three, ventilate. And again, we're going to be much more specific about that in part three, which is 3 p.m. Eastern today. So to start us off with context, Dr. Sanborn, can you please tell us, have we ever quarantined everyone at the same time before?
Not like this. There was a big epidemic, a pandemic in the 1918, of course, for influenza. And of course, we saw the polio virus that hit about a 30% of the population. But I don't think we've done it this way before.
Very interesting. Okay, so Joe, the homes that we're closing ourselves inside differ regionally, obviously, and by climate. But what is a reasonable list of general side effects that we might expect with everybody spending all day, every day inside a modern home this spring? Can't hear you, buddy.
Oh, we lost Joe's audio.
Can't hear you. Let me actually jump ahead. I'll come back to that question, if that's okay.
Test one, two.
Okay, all right, great.
Yeah.
Okay, wrong button's on. Okay, great. That's thanks, okay. Sorry. It's my first webinar. The answer to that is that you can't say those kind of statements because I could put us all in the same nasty contaminated house and we all have different symptoms. The issue is how many symptoms you might be having. But the real question now is that will you have more symptoms or will your symptoms become more severe? So those are the issues. But we now know that, you know, the home will no longer kind of settle because we keep messing with the home now. We're home more often. Carbon dioxide will go up. Particulates go up. Chemical use is going to go up. So all these things will increase our burden that our house usually we had relief from. We no longer have that kind of relief because we're in it too long. So this is truly the greatest experiment on humankind ever. And I just wish that we had more. You know, we actually have some of the best data out there in the individuals. We just need to figure out how to get that back from people that are now going to experience a new reality in their home. So that's one of our goals, is how to reach out and get that information back from individuals.
Very interesting. So Delphine, I would love to jump into your research that you just published. So Dr. Sanborn provided us with a 9-page list of EPA compliant virus fighting products, 9 pages, single spaced. So what side effects are these disinfectants that everybody's crazy about right now and hand sanitizer having on our bodies and on the air that we breathe in our homes?
Yeah, so this is a huge question. There are a lot of different ways to disinfect and sanitize. And I think there's some pieces of chemistry that everybody needs to know right now. And I think the first one is, I think my first message is going to be always you want to minimize the chemistry that you're being exposed to that's toxic, while also balancing that with our need to try and keep this coronavirus outside of our homes and preventing transmission. So what that really means is some of the old-fashioned techniques like soap and water, they do beautiful chemistry and it's not harmful to humans, but it's very harmful to the viruses, right? That soap acts to disrupt membranes of the virus, break them apart, and it can be very, very effective. There are some other really popular tools. A lot of these ones that are in these lists that the EPA has provided and a lot of other disinfection products that are popular, a lot of them are also very, very effective, but they can also be quite toxic. Bleach is the big one. We've been studying that in my lab for a while now. And so bleach does some really dangerous chemistry, very effective at killing viruses and bacteria and lots of other microbes, but it also, those same toxicities can impact you. And so I think my biggest message is that while bleach is really effective, it does chemistry and it reacts with your skin. It will react with the lining of your lungs. It will also react with other molecules that you have put down. So if you cleaned your house with something like Pine Sol or soap and water, great. But if you immediately go and clean with bleach solution, then you're going to kickstart a whole series of chemical reactions that are going to produce some potentially really toxic products. And that can be a real problem. We also have products like peroxide, alcohol, ammonia. All of those can disinfect in their own ways. The real problem is that they can react with each other. And that can produce a whole series of potentially really toxic products. The worst one is ammonia and bleach. And whatever you do, you have to keep those separated. But it's important to realize that if you clean your bathroom with ammonia and then you come back an hour later and you clean it with bleach because you're worried, that chemistry can still happen. And so I think it's a really important message that we can all get out is to, yes, disinfect, yes, clean, but don't allow different chemicals to mix because the potential for toxicity is really there. And I think we're all on board with trying to minimize people going to the hospital for any reason. And so this is one thing that everyone can do is to be really careful with your cleaners.
And I think you pointed out in the home chem experiment and in our later interviews that are hopefully be in season two of Home Diagnosis, which is on schedule, I'm hoping, that ventilation, like it says on the instruction manual, on the side of the bottle of bleach, how to apply this, right? And so can you talk a little bit about how that might have a side effect as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there are two aspects. One is, you know, mixing chemicals to manufacture instructions, they're there for a reason. And number two is all of those chemicals, they all say apply and ventilate your room. So turning on fans, opening windows, we have a ton of experts on this panel who know far more about ventilation than I do. But what I do as a chemist really understand is that you have to dilute any of these compounds, and that means clearing out the air as rapidly as possible. So when you clean, open up your windows. One of the side benefits of all the reduced traffic from fewer commuters and less industry is that our air quality outside is gonna be better. And so open those windows and there's so many reasons that that's good, but to get rid of to minimize your exposure to the toxic products from cleaners and disinfectants and any potential side products, that's really important. And I'll say that some of these side products, there's nothing you can do about it. We breathe out ammonia. When you cook, there are amino acids that are in the chicken or the beef or the food that you're cooking, and those are going to react with the bleach, and they will make some toxic products. So even if you're not mixing your chemicals, ventilating the house is one of the best things you can do to keep you and your family healthy.
And of course, it's pollen season, so opening your windows has a whole other side effect now of respiratory distress. By the way, so I'd like to have Joe and Bob and also Michelle tune in on or chime in on this next thing, which is that the other thing, aside from ventilate, is vacate, right? You're not supposed to be around the bleach while it's doing its little chemistry thing, right? So when we go to these necessary places, grocery stores, hospitals, wherever else, at the post office, I don't even know if the post office is still open, but they are cleaning with bleach probably or something that's doing, so what's happening to us when we go into these places that have to stay open, that we need to be able to get our toilet paper from when they are cleaning with these disinfectants?
Well, I mean, one of the things I jump in, you know, to reinforce what Delphine said, in my 30 years, I could tell you, numerous occasions I've seen interactions with ammonia and bleach, you know, unintentional, of course, but, you know, in cafeteria situations in schools where they're using a quaternary ammonia sanitizer in the dishwashing system, and the room monitors are going out and using a bleach solution on the dining tables out in the dining area, and then coming back and dumping the bucket into a common grease trap. You know, that one example. Healthcare facilities, ton of my clients are using this process where they're going in and using a quaternary ammonia cleaner and then coming in with a bleach, you know, a secondary, you know, they're trying to use a two-part clean and kill. Is that common, Michelle? Because, I mean, I've seen it in the Northeast. And that it doesn't seem to be as problematic in just patient areas where they're taking an interval between, but where there's high turnover rates like the ER, where they're doing fast room turnovers. Big problems because they're coming in, you know, housekeeping's coming in when it's the other product's still there and active. So I can't stress that enough. You know, the chemicals, you know, we didn't have a great environment indoors to begin with before we started this, and it hasn't improved with this situation. You know, actually putting ourselves in there, spending more occupancy, doing more activities over, you know, 24/7 now, it's definitely a concern.
Yeah, there's a real temptation to say, you know, if a little bit of cleaner is a good thing, then a lot of a cleaner has to be even better, right? And we've got, you know, I know people are sitting there. I have a family member who's sitting there with alcohol and peroxide and bleach and was saying, well, I'm just going to use all three. I was like, no, because all of that generates really dangerous chemistry, especially if you mix them together, but even if you layer them. And the layering, you know, one round, as you say in the hospitals, one round of one cleaner, even if you wait a half hour, an hour, another right. cleaner coming on top, you still get that chemistry.
There's still residual, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're really better off trying to think about one type of cleaner for a given surface and just sticking to that plan.
We have a follow-up audience question that jumps into this. The question is, doesn't the alcohol and hand sanitizer carry fragrance chemicals, et cetera, into the bloodstream? Anybody want to jump on that one?
Well, let me just jump in as an amateur, as the like the dum-dum on this, because I think that the idea that hand sanitizer is just sanitizer is silly when you can smell it. So what people are doing, the reason they keep saying wash your hands is better than sanitize your hands is because you have dead bugs on your hands now, and you have chemicals. And now you're going to go eat a sandwich and you just are putting all these chemicals and the dead bugs on your hands in your mouth, which is pretty gross. So again, like washing your hands, much better than hand sanitizing. I don't even use hand sanitizer in general. Delphine, do you have anything to add, or Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a balance of potential negative effects. And so if you're, you know, I would in no way, when I go to the grocery store and I come out before I get into my car, I am using hand sanitizer. I have someone with a vulnerable, who's in the vulnerable populations at home. And so I to me, that balance is worth it. But soap and water is in many ways an incredibly effective tool, and probably more effective than using hand sanitizer, and fewer side problems. So I think that's pretty clear. All of these chemicals, I mean, everything that we are using, is certainly your exposure, both through breathing it and eating it, is going to introduce those into your system, and I think it's a personal choice as to how much you're willing to do that at this point in time. And I think I'll leave it to Dr. Sanborn to chime in on that.
I would mention that for this virus, we recommend over 60% alcohol-based hand sanitizers, but keep in mind that alcohol can be absorbed through the skin into your bloodstream. So if we did a test to see if you've had alcohol, we would find it in your bloodstream. And also bear in mind that kids, you know, hand sanitizer is great for kids because it's quick and easy, but you know, they can lick their hands and then they're exposed to alcohol. So just keep it in the back of your mind, risks and benefit balance.
So in that chat, I put two nice links, one of which is a New York Times article showing why soap is more effective than any hand sanitizer that you could have. And it shows molecularly how it actually breaks down and disrupts viruses, which is a way I didn't know. I did my homework last night because I didn't want to show up here and just talk about stuff that I didn't know about. So I tried to do that, as well as I gave you a link to Environmental Working Group, which actually evaluates these types of green cleaners. And they have their own lab that they send stuff out. So the link there also gives you recommendations to green or better cleaners, or if a hand sanitizer met their approval, or they also disclose chemicals that the manufacturer may not.
Yeah. And one thing to add into there is that one of the beauties of soap is a virus is like a little droplet of grease. It's a little more complicated than that, but you can disrupt the membranes and break apart that using just simple soap. I noticed that on the Q&A, someone's asked about Windex, and I think that's a really interesting one. So some forms of Windex have ammonia in them, but my understanding is they don't meet the established criteria for killing off the microbes and viruses. And so they're great. They're potentially good for cleaning your windows. They're not, I wouldn't think of them as a disinfection. I think there you want to go and look at some of these EPA, FDA, WHO recommended cleaners. And again, soapy water is great. Dilute made to manufacturer instructions, bleach or peroxide or alcohol. But as Dr. Tamar says, you've gotta be, your alcohol has to be over 60% if you actually want to be effective.
A note to audience, those of you who are asking questions, there is a tab that says answered questions. So if you're looking for the links or other answers, you got to click on answered to see the results.
Great. While we're on the topic of chemistry, just for a second, I just went on Amazon 5 minutes before we started this, and right now you can search ozone generator and find 350 products with thousands of positive reviews that claim to sterilize your home. I would like to open this up to everyone. Why would this be completely insane for anyone to do in their home?
Oh, no, zone.
It is so toxic. It's a key component of air pollution. Ozone, it reacts with your skin surfaces. It reacts with the lining of your lungs. Exposing you and other people to extra ozone is that's a whole different set of medical problems and long-term health problems you are exposing yourself to. It's from a health perspective, the science is incredibly well established that ozone is really toxic. And so I cannot discourage anyone enough from using ozone in their homes, particularly if anyone is living there.
The challenge is that many of these home purifiers or portable units have electronic static cleaning parts of them that actually are trying to, you know, put in one positive charge and then collect it to the negative charge, which can create a small amount of ozone, which in the industry is considered to be an acceptable amount of ozone and not hazardous, which we don't believe in at all. Any ozone is bad ozone. So, and they're included in most of the units. So our advice is get one and understand how to turn it off immediately so that you're just getting the filtration or the carbon filter. If you have that, that's the most effective part of what these things do. They grab stuff and you throw them away. So I would not be aware of how your unit works and how to turn that system off.
And to be clear, Joe's talking about get a filter. If you need an air purifier or filtration, just get something that has a fan and a filter on it. And that's all the electronics that you need. By the way, the ozone is also a fuel for chemistry. Like it's basically jet fuel, pouring it on all your stuff. We're talking about bleach and ammonia and all that stuff. And the tests that you would see people saying, oh, it creates very little ozone. They're testing it in the air. And ozone is very sticky. So it comes out and it immediately sticks to surfaces or reacts with something. So it disappears. So testing the air, if I'm correct, Delphine, please correct me if I'm wrong, is a silly measurement. Because even if you get a tiny bit in the air, it means there's a lot that was created and stuck to things immediately.
Yeah, we did an experiment in home chem where we had an empty, as in no people in it house, and we added ozone at high levels using one of these little commercial ozone generators. We sent it straight into the ventilation system. And so we measured the amount of ozone coming straight out of the generator, and we knew it was incredibly high. And then we were also measuring the ozone inside the house, and it rose, but it was actually quite low. And what that told us was that all of these ozone molecules were reacting on the surfaces inside the house. And there's damage you can do to your building and to electronics, rubber, anything that's plastic, doing that. But it also told me that if there was anyone living inside the house at the time, anyone breathing, then they would be exposed to very high levels. And so that was a real wake-up call. And as Corbett said, you're just fueling chemistry. And if there's one thing you should be doing inside your home, it's trying to reduce the amount of chemistry that you have, because chemistry is going to the actual chemical reactions occurring inside your home. That's how you can produce formaldehyde and isocyanic acid and all sorts of different molecules that all have different health problems. And the goal here, especially as we're spending all this time inside your home, is trying to make your home as healthy as possible, because that's the reason you're here. So there's trying to stop any coronaviruses from coming in, trying to kill any that are in your house, but there's also keeping you and your family healthy at the same time. And that means really reducing that chemistry.
Absolutely.
I asked Bob to bring up a slide briefly because we think that the challenge of, in fact, somebody went to Home Depot, one of our staff went to Home Depot and said that you couldn't buy a freezer, but the air purifiers, the portable generators, whatever, all those things where the clean air were, plenty of them on the shelf. The people were not freaking out about that. We recommend just getting a box fan and a 3-inch MERV 13 filter and just taping them together and you can buy multiples for the same price of another one. I know that contradicts a lot of manufacturers, but in general, the more filtration you can do, you know, the better off you are. So you can get those devices. I have those devices, so I'm not saying don't buy something that is that. No, there's a slide that actually shows how to make your own box fan filtration system where you just get a 3-inch MERV filter. We recommend MERV 13.
Is that the slide you wanted, Joe?
Yes, 20 by 20.
You're killing me, man.
Tape them together. Well, that's what I put in there, the slide with that. So anyway. So there is a, it's a simple thing to do. Many of you have seen these things, and we think they're now a simple thing that you can still, I think you can still buy a box fan at any of the stores that sell them. They have not gone off the shelves until today. That's it. They're going to be gone. And you get your filter from Amazon or someplace similar.
Joe just started a buying panic.
That's right. Yeah, right.
That's one of the things I love about you is your props. You always have very interesting ways of putting things together to make a very effective model. So let me move us on for a second. So surface stuff, because this is one of the differences with this virus. First of all, the main difference between outdoor atmospheric chemistry and indoor atmospheric chemistry. Delphine, you please feel free to chime in on this once I get done with my little intro. The main difference is surface to volume ratio, right? So there's so many more surfaces inside of a home than there are outdoors, even in a forest. So when we're talking about a virus that can last much longer on surfaces than a normal virus can, and Dr. Sanborn, can you please tell us how long these things can last, how long the virus itself can last on a surface?
Yeah, this particular coronavirus is unusual in that it can last for days on surfaces. After the initial respiratory droplet.
Up to like a week, right?
Probably up to a week, definitely days.
Okay.
So it diminishes over time, now, yeah.
Right, so if I can, I don't know who exactly would like to chime in on this, but particles, so like if you take dust, right? A dust particle, and if you look up into the sunlight streaming through your window, you can see little bits of dust floating along. Those are technically surfaces too. So I'm wondering, can a virus project from your mouth in a fine mist and then glom onto a piece of dust and then float around and not drop to the ground or drop, you know what I mean? Like, how does the, first of all, surface to volume ratio and also the fact that we've got particles and dust kind of floating around inside the space, how do these impact what's going on?
So I can take the particle side. And that's the amount of time that a particle will remain suspended in air in the indoor environment really depends on its size. So the coronavirus itself, if it's not in any droplet, just bare virus, is 120 nanometers. So it's really, really small. And that should last something, it would last in the air inside a home, something on the order of half an hour. But most of the, when you cough or even when you talk, or breathe, you emit respiratory droplets, and those are larger, and they can contain viruses. They can contain different numbers. I think it's relatively poorly understood, and it's going to be very individual dependent how many viruses are in any given respiratory droplet. But then those can stay suspended in air for hours. And that's where ventilating your house, there are a lot of things you can do to control how long particles will remain in suspended. I think these box fans that Joe is talking about are with a filter attached are a great way to try and reduce the amount of time that those particles are going to be suspended in air. So that amount of time is going to depend on their size. The really, really big ones that you can see when someone's coughing with a lot of production, then those aren't going to go very far. They're going to settle on surfaces, and then that's the surface source that Michelle's been talking about. But then those particles, if they last longer, they can get transported throughout the house. And we can see that when you cook, and you know this, when you cook in one room in your kitchen, and you can smell the bread baking, or you can see the burned smoke from the toast come into another bedroom, that should give you an intuitive sense as to how long and how far some of these particles can travel.
A couple of follow-up questions from the online audience. Speaking of a question about whole house ventilators, versus whole house air filtration, And then the follow-up to that was also using HEPA filtration in conjunction with either UVC or some other technology with that. You know, how effective is that with dealing with COVID-19 as far as being aerosolized? But again, I'm understanding that that's not going to stay aerosolized all that long.
The studies that I found about aerosolization was about 10 to 30 minutes, but that was in a kind of a controlled environment. So the other question which was brought up about dust, and that is that depends on how active your house is. Most homes probably were active for a few hours in the evening. If you have younger kids, your home is a dust nightmare right now. So if you have a bunch of people, little kids running around, especially the kids are lower to the carpet and the dust already is an issue. So there is this, you know, if you have two seniors at home, there's probably not a lot of activity that's causing these issues. But in homes where you have the most impacted people are those who have younger kids who are home, you know, jumping off the walls and jumping off the furniture. I know Corbett is in that situation, so maybe many others are. Yeah.
A couple of follow-ups there too is both from our chat and our Q&A. How does anybody have a handle on how long viruses would this virus, we don't really know a lot about, but it, in general, a coronavirus, how long can it survive on a filter surface of, let's say, an air filter? What happens when that droplet desiccates, dries out? Can that virus still stay viable when it's no longer on that suspended saliva droplet?
So there's a very recent paper that shows that the virus will remain viable. Also, to what extent that is and how infectious that is a very different question. But it does remain viable on cardboard for about 24 hours. And from a chemistry perspective, your HEPA filter and cardboard aren't so different. So I think that's one piece of information. I think HEPA filters are fantastic. And I know that a lot of hospitals use UV light to disinfect. It can be a very effective disinfectant. As a chemist, I am always a little worried with UV light because it, again, can do some really interesting and toxic chemistry. So, but these, there are enclosed systems, I know, for buildings that incorporate UV light and HEPA filtration. And I think if properly done, that's a really interesting idea.
I'll take the dangerous avenue of chiming in on UV. So the studies that we have found show that it has struggles to purify air as it moves over it because of the amount of time it has as an exposure. Yep. It does have a much greater effect when it actually is able to be used on a fan coil as long as the entire fan coil is covered, which means both sides and doesn't have shadows created by the environment. So that's very effective from our perspective, but just having it run right by a fan, by the light in a matter of a fraction of a second. So we think a plenum needs to be around 10 to 20 feet long with a light that long to maybe consider to be fully effective. So if you're going to find the studies, don't find a study from a manufacturer. Try to find an independent study because everybody can create their own result in their own lab. So that's my caution to you about those kind of lights.
So just as a quick review for everybody who's watching, do not let your mom and dad buy an ozone generator. Don't let them mix chemicals. Don't let them rush out and buy a UV light for their HVAC system. Also, the filtration level that Joe was mentioning earlier, MERV 13, is not HEPA. HEPA is MERV 17 to 20. So if you want a HEPA system, that means you're going to have to get a bigger surface area. If you were to jam a HEPA filter into your furnace, it would probably break the furnace. Yeah, so don't do that. So here's the slide that Joe was talking about with a nice wide media. You see that filter is 4 inches wide. Many of you do not have a filter slot that is 4 inches wide. Yours is 1 inch wide. So don't, you know, this is not going to work on your furnace. But Joe's point is to increase the circulation. And I'd just like to make a point that we're going to talk more about later at 3 o'clock. The house that I'm building right now outside that window is a high performance house. It's modern and it's built to modern code. So it's more airtight, it's more insulated. Therefore, it's going to have a smaller HVAC system. And so it gets less circulation. So the amount, even if I had a HEPA filter, which I do, the amount of air inside the entire volume of my house that's going through that filter on an hourly basis is minuscule because it's just such an efficient place to live. So this is kind of one of the places where energy efficiency and home health are at odds with each other. And that's what Joe is trying to fix with this box fan.
Well, the other, it only works when it's on. if for your furnace. So if you have your filtration, you're like, hey, I have a really great filter, and it only works when your system is running. Now, some systems are sophisticated to run regularly to do that, but don't think that you could just take your system and turn it to on and try to filter your house, because you have no idea the impacts of infiltration as well as energy bills that could produce.
Right. I think the one point that, you know, we kind of skirted over, but we didn't really cover, is that if people are going to be self-quarantining and staying in their home environments a lot, you know, longer than usual per week, per day, all the existing issues that we've been worried about with indoor air quality and problems with buildings and microbiological and, you know, off-gassing for formaldehyde and a bunch of other things, you know, are we not radically increasing our amount of exposure, you know, with just longer time in there? And how do we deal with that? You throw it at Michelle.
I just like to add to that, which is that the part of an intro that I had written last night that Joe was like, that's a little negative. And you're right, is that I wasn't really convinced when we were just talking about death toll stuff. I was like, okay, you know, people die all the time. That's a man, you know, horrible way to think about it. But the thing that is interesting here is that what Bob just brought up is that kids get asthma and allergies symptoms from houses. And a lot of people know this. Joe would have a lot of data about this. But I would say that if we saturate all the hospital beds in the country with COVID cases and people are stuck there for weeks having a machine breathe for them, then kids can't have allergies and asthma. We can't have babies. We can't have people getting cancer, because now we've totally saturated the system. So that's kind of one of the issues here, is that we've got this health concern and we're solving it by putting people into another health risky situation in their homes. And again, I'm having nightmares thinking about some of the homes that I've tested over the years and seeing the crawl spaces of and things like that. So anybody else have anything to?
Well, the stats so are. Go ahead. No, please go ahead, yeah. Joe.
No, I was just going to say that leads us to the slide, the flattening the curve slide. So if you think of coronavirus as a bad mutated cold that we do not have any immune system for because it's novel, then we will all get symptoms if we're exposed. Now, some of us get very mild symptoms and some of us get very severe symptoms. Some people don't even know they have it, and so they're more likely to spread it. So that's why, if you look at the slide, flattening the curve, it shows why we're all here hibernating in our houses. Is because if everybody gets it all at once, if 95% of the population gets it all at once, we don't have the capabilities to handle it and we're gonna crash. But if you can, you know, some people can get it over here instead of over here, then we'll be better equipped to handle it, and we can handle the allergies and the asthma on top of the coronavirus.
And as Delphine mentioned earlier, you emit these droplets not just when you cough and sneeze. If you are talking or breathing, you are emitting droplets that can stay in the air for what you just said was an hour or two, right?
Yeah.
Do not let your parents go to, I think that all of us are having these conversations with our parents, trying to like get them to stay home and not go out, which is the funny reversal of when we were teenagers. Can we talk for a second about humidity? What's the existing evidence about the relative humidity and viruses? If we keep the house dry, which is one of the things that I listed at the very top, is that going to help with the virus transmission?
So there's some research. It seems there's not a lot out there on coronavirus, but there is a little bit that suggests you can reduce the movement throughout a room using higher humidity. But we're not talking about damp houses or damp buildings, so don't go flood your basement but for many reasons, but there is some emerging research that suggests that higher humidity is going to reduce how far these the respiratory droplets, etc., can transmit. That said, how much humidity, how far are we talking about stopping it? We don't have the research out there about that yet.
I have a slide that answers this question for us, because I found two research papers that actually show this concept that they did studies in the hospitals of 370 some patients with 8 million data points to confirm that when humidity was low, the virus had the flu virus and similar viruses had a high rate of transmission. And so then they increased it to at least above 40, and they reduced the conditions, and they explain in the paper, Bob has a slide, I'll put the link here in the chat in a minute, that it was actually when your skin is dry that you have more flakiness and more things that actually become more airborne, and that the virus has the ability to transmit more because you are actually releasing this kind of condition, that you have higher humidity, that your body did not do that as much, as well as it was more receptive to combat those kind of conditions. So there was two research conditions that I found last night that were pretty, changed my view about relative humidity. I was like, holy cow, this is, it's one thing for us to all talk about it. I've always been concerned about the top half above 60, 65, but I was now convinced that below 70 is actually a potential issue in your homes.
Joe, this is a slide you wanted up, the graph?
No, that's actually the one. This actually refers to briefly what you talked about staying home. You can see where Japan is. They actually caught on quicker, but Singapore and Hong Kong within the first week did what you may do in other extreme circumstances where you say, oh, they're having issues. That area is quarantined immediately, and they shut down schools, shut down everything in isolated areas that prevented the spread of the coronavirus in Singapore and Hong Kong. You can see that they were super active in testing and restricting people's movements within, you know, 10 days of the days since 100 cases showed up. Most everybody else did not get that, and we are on the other curve to follow everybody else.
You're looking at that one right
there.
That's
okay. Yeah, thanks. So, no, that's ventilation. There's another one on humidity.
But I do want to jump in, and maybe Michelle, you can also add your two cents here. I think that there is some research about flu and cold viruses, but the coronavirus that we're talking about right now, it's a slightly different beast, and it may behave a bit differently from some of these other ones. So my understanding is that while we can use some guidance out of flu and cold research, it's still a little open and uncertain as to how relevant that's going to be. Michelle, maybe you can add to that.
I agree. One thing we do know possibly is that it doesn't like heat, which is kind of funny. So one of the questions is, is it going to go away when the summer months come? We don't know. We just, it's a wait and see on that one.
That's why everybody's at the beach in Florida.
There you go.
I'd like to just distinguish real quick, because microbes seem to in turns freak people out and also engender this feeling of, like Dauphine and Nina at HomeChem taught us, that we are not individuals, we are a planet, and I have bugs living inside me and on my skin, and they're everywhere. So I'm really like a collection of bugs and individual little pieces. So microbes are going to be one of the victims of this disinfectant thing that we're doing, right? We're gonna basically like wipe out all the ecosystems on the surfaces around us that we're trying to disinfect, which is the same thing as taking a bunch of antibiotics. And then when you're done with that, we're gonna have to eat yogurt and eat probiotics and try and get that healthy thing going back on. So I'd like to maybe, so first of all, Michelle, can you talk a little bit about the difference between a virus and a bacteria or a microbe in the classical sense?
Well, I'll throw fungi in there too. Throw fungi in as well.
Sure.
That's the harder one to go.
And then Delphine, if you could kind of take that ball and run with it on the kind of how the recolonization works when we're done with this period. So take it away, Dr. Sandler.
So viruses tend to be, this is off the cuff. So viruses tend to be, I believe, smaller than bacteria. We fight it with a different part of our immune system. So if you think, I'll take antibiotics for this, it's not going to work because it's not bacteria. Antibiotics are for bacteria. Antivirals are for, our viruses, like the influenza virus. We don't have that many viral medications right now, especially this. They're working on it. And then as far as, clinical symptoms, you're going to have more long-term effects with the bacteria. The viruses tend to be short-lived. Now, if you start out with a virus, and then you can get bacterial superinfection, so you start out with a coronavirus, and then you get a pneumonia with a different bacteria, that can happen. And we see that in our, most severe patients with this.
Yeah. And I'm gonna add in a few things we learned in HomeChem about microbes in general. And so, as we're learning, there are viruses, there are bacteria, there are fungi. So that's your mold. with spores. They all have different health effects. They all need to be dealt with in very different ways. From a chemistry perspective, something that we learned is that if you mop the floors, if you mop your floors with bleach, according to manufacturer instructions, clear out as much of the microbes as you think, you will still have some component of a resilient population left. And they're not necessarily dangerous. They're not necessarily bad. We don't know. But you are still going to have, it's hard to actually kill everything inside your home. So your home is filled with different microbes. Again, not necessarily bad, but they are there in our built environment. So our home is living as well as, So yes, you're going to end up clearing off some of those microbes. Some will stay. In terms of what's going on in your house, I don't think there are negative health effects to killing off the microbes. I think in terms of your own body, there's a established literature that says that's an issue. And so very clearly, you want to use the right tool for the right job. And if you're dealing with viruses, right, you want to use the appropriate antivirals. But from a cleaning your house and surface perspective, then those are all the, I mean, it's the over 60% alcohol, the bleach according to manufacturers, directions, soapy water, those are all good ways to do it as long as they're done separately. I wouldn't worry about killing off the microbes in the house, but I think it's something that we're gonna have to see what happens when people when they get better with this virus and what happens to their microbial populations. But I don't think that's top of my priority list right now to be concerned about. We'll see down the road.
Let everybody know, we'll run a little long to cover these questions. So I know some of you are trying to get questions in there. We're trying to cover them, but not totally disrupt our flow as much as possible. So we'll stay online a little bit past that 12 noon mark and try to cover these all for you.
It will be interesting to see what happens, because if you look at history medically, when we took away parasites, we don't usually have worms in the United States, but they have worms overseas. When we took that away, some of our allergies got worse. So yeah, maybe our allergies would get worse.
Many of you may be familiar with Rob Dunn's book, Never Home Alone, which, don't look at the cover, it's not about bugs and stuff in your house. It's about that we've been changing our environment slowly and slowly to try to make it sterile. And as you pointed out, once you do that, then you only allow something else that's worse to then come in and take its place. You now said, oh, hey, you're free to now roam and actually take over. And some of those things we now don't understand how to combat or actually how to get back to a normal ecology. So we are not helping ourselves with our sterile mentality that we have right now.
Absolutely. So we've got 10 minutes left in the original schedule. And like Bob said, we'll go long so we can answer some of these questions. Some of these questions have been answered already in the session. But I'm kind of, kind of like scrolling through here. And I just wanted to, let's just start listing some of them. So it's interesting. Would you comment on the use of plants inside the house to help? Any specific ones that can help against viruses?
Nope. They're not an effective way to clean your hair. You're definitely not to clean your hair. They're not an effective way to clean your air, and nor are they an effective way to deal with viruses. That said, there isn't much negative downside from them as long as they're not toxic to you or your pet. So go to town with your indoor garden, but it's not going to help you with the viruses. Mm-hmm.
Caleb is asking, a lot of biologists agree, a lot, and he says, not all, that viruses aren't living organisms. And that definition of living is debatable. They are more like androids, created fully formed and rely on actual living organisms to replicate and sustain. That means that they lack the machinery to recreate themselves, so they have to hook onto something else. But in this way, they're kind of like sperm, right, Michelle?
Well, they are somewhat symbiotic. They have to have an organism to be living on. That said, we know that they can live, at least this one can live on surfaces, as we said, up to days by itself without another organism. But eventually it will have to cling on to something to prolong its life. Otherwise it will just die out.
So it is a little different than a microbe, but I think that we fight probably the same way in spaces, right? Not with antibiotics or antivirals, but the disinfectants that you were talking about, Delphine, will work on both, right?
Yeah, yeah. The home approach to dealing with them is going to be the same as if you were dealing with bacteria. And I think it, to an extent with mold, although of course we have this humidity shift where I think with mold, you're always trying to dry the house. And here we're talking about maybe some elevated humidity being a good idea. But yet the way we fight viruses is going to be very similar to the way we fight bacteria.
Follow up
to
that too.
Outside the home, not in your body, obviously.
You know, with that humidity increase though, you know, proposing that, and Bill Turner had a question or a comment on that from Turner Sciences up in Portland, Maine. That, you know, if we start increasing our, most of these homes are not, that we currently live in, especially in the north, are not really designed to elevate the humidity, especially during this time of year or even any time of year. So, you know, we have to, I think we have to be cautious. I know that this is like, it's the lesser of two evils. But if you know, if we raise the moisture levels in the house to try to make it less hospitable to the virus, we could create, you know, a whole host of other fungal related problems in the space. Dust Absolutely. Mites are going to increase. Everything's going to increase when we do that.
Yeah. And there's an interesting issue that, I mean, as I say, the research isn't really clear about how far the transmission is going to stop. So, I mean, I think one cautious approach is to think that if someone is actually ill inside your home, then the room that they have hopefully quarantined themselves in, that would be a great place for a small portable humidifier. But I think that's a fantastic point that you have to work with the house that you have and the knock-on effects of high humidity, I think we should be very, very cautious of. As I say, the research on coronavirus and environmental conditions, it's still in its infancy. You know, normally we spend we've known about flu for many decades, and Michelle can comment on all of the research that we've done with that. This is a novel virus, and that means there just isn't a large research base to work from.
Somebody, Michael is asking, what about a sauna? Should I go to the sauna every day? Will it kill everything on our skin?
Some people would believe so. Some people would argue for that.
Probably Scandinavians.
Definitely.
That's right.
Everything is about the sauna.
Well, I mean, isn't there truth that anything that would, you know, there are health benefits with sauna, right? So, you know, it's part of this being able to defend yourself against exposure, right, is to actually have yourself in top health. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And you know what, one of the things that there's been some very established research on is that lower stress levels mean a healthier person. And so if going to the sauna reduces your stress levels, go for it. I think it's not going to kill everything on your skin by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think there is I don't think there's any harm in continuing a normal and healthy practice of sauna. If I had one in my house, I'd probably take advantage of it on occasion.
I'd like to talk about ventilation before
finding one that's open. I was just saying the trick is to find a public one that's actually open.
Yeah. And then maintaining 6 feet and not touching any surfaces.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think private ones would be the way to
go. I've been too close to the panel all day. I apologize.
Yeah, it's your right. panel, though.
So
you're separated by 2,000 miles.
We just started a private
miles.
Sauna buying booms. And now we've got two economy splashes that we've made.
There you go.
What were you going to say, Joe, about ventilation?
Yeah, I think that we start. I have a slide about it, that there are other studies that show that increased ventilation can also be a incredibly preventative measure. Again, not necessarily against coronavirus. We don't know a lot about that, but in general about flus and other things they've studied. So I have a slide that shows that. I already posted the link in there already. So they actually made the dramatic statement that it could be almost somewhat effective as the preventative measures from, giving everybody their flu shot. They felt that it had a 50% equivalent to that. So, there's the access is there. I put the link already in our chat window, and you can have access to that. So, anyway, this was kind of opened my eyes last night about how ventilation can. And now ventilation is a variety of opportunities. Just opening your windows on opposite sides of the house can do that. It can also impact your humidity levels depending on temperatures. There's, you know, everything has, house is a system. Everything impacts something else. But we believe one of the foundations of a good house is that it has really good independent balanced ventilation. So there are, I think it's one of the postings that's going to happen out of this is people are going to reevaluate their home and what measures they can do to make it more safe or preventative for some of these conditions.
You know, one thing we didn't cover at all, it was no mention of, and this one is near and dear to me because I've made a paradigm shift in the last several days. The Surgeon General came out and dissuaded people from wearing surgical masks in the general public because they're not designed to actually protect you from inhaling things. So, you know, if you were going to wear a mask, it would be an N95 mask or a, even a P100, like a HEPA type mask would protect the individual. But I think the one paradigm shift that I had is, wait a second, if we're really trying to limit exposure, you know, is there not a benefit though to the general public, especially ones that may be contaminated, you know, may be affected and, have the virus not know it, to wear a surgical mask as they're doing in Asia? Because it is limiting your ability to spew things out, you know, into somebody else's breathing zone. Thoughts?
I would agree that if you are sick and you are going out in public, it can't hurt to wear the mask. And also it protects you from other things.
That said though, right, I think one of the concerns is that, I mean, I think it's a fantastic thing for people. It's going to stop those respiratory droplets from coming out. So if you have it or you're possibly, you know, have this virus, that's a great way to prevent, to reduce the spread. That said, these surgical masks are not, they're not fitted. They don't cover your face. And so we have a lot of outdoor air pollution research actually that shows how masks work in terms of stopping small particles, i.e. the size of these droplets and these viruses from getting in. And so from those perspectives, you have to have a fitted at least N95 mask. And so these surgical masks aren't fitted. So as you're breathing, if you're in the presence of other people, those small particles are going to be able to come in through the sides of the mask very effectively. And so I think one of the concerns about people wearing surgical masks to prevent themselves from acquiring those viruses is going to give people a false sense of security. And they're going to feel like they're invincible and you can go out into public and you've got your mask on. And that's just not true, because these viral particles, these respiratory droplets, they can absolutely move into these masks. And so it's really there to stop people from spreading the disease if you think you're infected. But it's not a great approach for stopping people, for stopping you from acquiring the virus. And I think one thing that's very clear right now is that a lot of our medical systems do not have enough PPE. So I would say that anybody who has large amounts of these masks, they're not going to stop you from getting infected. So unless you or a family member is sick and is trying to not share that disease, then you know these need to go to the folks who really do need to use them in combination with other forms of protective equipment.
But I do think that ends up, focusing on that point is that it, you know, wearing the surgical type mask isn't going to protect you. I think we all agree on that. But perhaps there is a social responsibility that you're going to limit your potential to distribute contaminant out of your body to others. It's not going to protect you, but it's and I know it's kind of un-American. We're always, you know, we don't tend to worry about others as much as we should maybe. But I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think it's just really important that the general consumers understand the difference, right? The surgical mask is limiting you from contaminating others. The fitted mask is protecting you from breathing in others' contaminant. So there's two ways of looking at it. And since we aren't, you know, we really don't have a lot of testing out there yet, as far as we don't really have a good number in the populace, do we, Michelle? As far as, I mean,
we do not.
There's got to be like 100-fold or more actually people
sure.
carrying it.
We are seeing the tip of the iceberg. Just imagine if you have a cough and shortness of breath, maybe a fever, maybe not. You just assume you have a coronavirus. You are guilty mm-hmm. until proven innocent.
Yeah.
And okay,
masks come in. That's is right there. You think you might have a cold. you start wearing those masks. That's it.
I'm not afraid to wear the mask. There's a strange thing about when I travel a lot, and Americans are like, I don't need no freaking mask. You know, you're weird for wearing a mask.
Oh, my mask the first F-bomb in this entire webinar, Joe.
I wear my mask. Once I get in the airport, my mask is on, and I don't care what people think. Because I'm like, it doesn't matter. I mean, I dress casually, and I put on a mask. And I think that it doesn't hurt to feel that it's okay to do those things. So I'm not wiping down, silly things as I go through the airport, but I promote that, wearing a mask doesn't hurt anybody and it only protects you. N95 is obviously the best way to go. A breathing apparatus on the mask is actually even better. So, if more people were wearing masks a long time ago, I think we could have prevented some of the exposures.
Just so you know, though, as Delphine mentioned, you have to have it fitted and you can't have hair, you can't have things in the way. It's very hard to get that seal.
Yeah.
And so some people have to shave.
Anything is better than.
But I think you've got to be careful with that. I think it's I think what Bob's got, he's going to be good to go.
This is for professionals that are dealing, and we're dealing with environmental exposures, asbestos, mold, all that stuff. You know, that's a full fitted HEPA mask is really, that's going to give you some protection.
We promote N95 masks and I agree. We describe fitting it to your face, right? I'm not going to shave.
Moderator is going to step in as the sergeant at arms. And I'm going to say, first of all, thank you to the 162 participants that we've had in this thing. We have 24 questions stacked up in the Q&A panel. We've got chat stuff going on. There is no way that we're going to take this long enough to answer all the questions that keep coming up. So I'm going to say everybody should tune back in at 1 o'clock and then at 3 o'clock where we're going to take these questions and we're going to shuttle them over to the next session. I'd like to end on this sense of false security, which is what we are all talking about today in this staying home is making us feel safe. And of course, lesser of two evils is what we're really talking about here. It is important that you sequester yourself, that you quarantine yourself, because the government has the constitutional right to quarantine us by law and put us in prison or fine us if we don't. Don't let them do that. Let's all just be nice about it and do it yourself. Thank you very much to Michelle, Joe, Delphine, and Bob for being here and lending your expertise. We will pick this back up at 1 o'clock. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Corbett. Thank you, Bob. And everybody who joined us.
So we're going to stay on. We are going to stay online here from Healthy Indoors, and any panelists that can still, participate. This won't be official discussion, but we can stay on. Corbett, I think we could probably cover a couple of these questions now.
I'm going to go take a break because I'll be back at work.
Go for it. Let's see if we can cut through some of them because we're going to get stacked up with the second session too. So, let's see which ones we have.
Can I do something in reverse, Bob?
Do it.
So those of you that are in the chat or in the question, how about giving us some information about what do you think your week will be like next week? Like I'm home with my kids. I still go to work. I will be out as much as possible, or I'm home 24 hours a day. I would like to kind of get a little sense of the people that are on this kind of call as to what your week will be like next week. If you could kind of chime in and tell us what's going on with you, it would be a great resource. Not all at once, everybody. Okay, just so you know.
there was an acetone question while we're waiting for other ones to come in that somebody did ask twice. I just want to scroll back and find it. Okay.
I'll be signing off now, but thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
Nice to meet you, Michelle.
Nice to meet you, too.
All right. Yeah.
I can be around for a few more minutes. So
yeah, and if you have to roll, I understand. Joe, you're probably available to stay in a little bit, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no. I knew you would
be. This is my life. I'm actually online.
This is how we live. Yeah, and I'm an online trainer and publisher, so I never leave.
Yeah, I can take any chemistry questions, and then I'll scoot off.
Yeah, I want to get that acetone question. Carol, do you know where that is? Can you scroll it up for us?
Oh, I see it at the top. Will acetone take care of COVID-19? No, there isn't any research to suggest that that's an appropriate disinfectant. So at this point, I think you're better off. I'm gonna stick to the soapy water. And then for times when you're really concerned, then dilute solutions of bleach, according to manufacturer's instructions, over 60% alcohol, peroxide solutions, none of those mixed together in any way, shape, or form. But acetones, not a great idea. And yeah, it can definitely go through your skin and into your bloodstream, can irritate lungs. So generally one of those chemicals that's a good idea to keep outside of the home.
Great. There was an earlier question from a restoration contractor, I believe, cleaning large spaces. How do you pre-test and post-test for the virus when you're using a chemical that states on the label for use on human coronavirus? In other words, saying that there's products that are already in the marketplace that are generally listed as effective against human coronavirus, but we really don't know, first of all, COVID-19, if that's the case, right? I mean,
right. I think it's a good place to start. It's a very reasonable place to start. Are those listed products approved by the government? And I'll just, yeah, those same ones that we've been talking about. Those are pretty good. And I think you're making a good case for thinking that those are useful. In terms of knowing if it's on a surface before or after, that requires testing, and so that's research labs. And I think that honestly the capacity just isn't there in this country right now. Any labs that have the capacity to test are mostly working on actual human population testing. I think some things will come down the line in the future, so we can learn more about it, about how these microbes sit on surfaces. But we're left with some pretty thin science right now.
That's what I was thinking too. And Joe, if you've heard this, but I don't think there's an awful lot at our disposal. Thinking in the indoor environmental community, we really don't have the ability to go out and field test for this.
PRISM sent out an email saying that it's beyond their capabilities right now. So they're one of the resources that many of us use for that type of, I'm sure other testing places that do that type of surface sample say it's right now it's not there.
Yeah, I think if anybody is telling you that they have that capacity in a commercial setting and it's not for human testing, I would be pretty questionable on the shall we say the analytical chemistry of that.
And don't buy that toothpaste that says it'll stop coronavirus either.
Yeah. Please, or the silver solution.
Yeah.
Good God. And that's the problem. That's one of the things that that really prompted us to have this event is just this incessant influx of misinformation on a daily basis. And hopefully, we've been able to at least give some credible information out there. We certainly don't have we're not the end all authorities on any of it. This is an evolving situation, but we're at least trying to stay on top of it, give people reasonable basis of information to go on.
There was one that Bill brought up, which we didn't talk about, and that is that we are now living in one of the best outdoor air environments ever. So now's the time to go out and do your own personal exercise. And I wanted to address the question I sent to you guys, which from Bill was about outdoor ozone and how that could be impacting some of the other conditions. We talked about indoor ozone generators, but outside ozone is also impactful.
Yeah. So outside ozone is going to, with the less traffic, fewer sources of outdoor air pollutants, outdoor ozone is going to, it's either going to stay the same or it's going to decrease in most areas. And when I say that decrease, that means the air is just going to be cleaner. There will be less ozone in it on ground level. So it is less of a concern than it would be in many other cities. So it's going to be less ozone exposure, open up those windows, and we'll have fewer of the ozone-induced chemical reactions. So it's just going to be cleaner air quality outside. If there's any silver lining to that, that's what we've got. And that's we saw that in Wuhan in China. The satellite measurements and air quality sensors were very, very clear that with the huge shutdown in industry and traffic, the air quality, particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, ozone, it all cleaned up. And so far lower concentrations of all of those pollutants. And so depending on the extent to which we actually shut down, that may be the case here in the United States as well.
Is this a short-term solution for climate change?
Is what?
We all just stayed home forever. That, you know,
I don't think coronavirus is a good, it is not an optimal solution for climate change, but we'll see what happens in terms of, I think one great thing is that we're all learning to use these online tools. And so hopefully a lot of people will start to realize that the conferences they flew across the country for were maybe not necessary and there are some alternatives. That's going to be a good thing in terms of pollution.
Bob, you want to talk briefly about what you're hoping to do over the next month?
Yeah. A couple of things. I mean, with the publications, you know, with health, but predominantly with Healthy Indoors, which is under our own wheelhouse, we'll be doing more online, free community information as much as possible. Because I just think it's just valuable to give people, an opportunity to at least hear from some experts and get, get something other than just unvetted articles on the internet. Because that's certainly questionable. So there's a couple of questions here that I think were really important. Somebody being at home, ordering, getting their provisions in, right? I mean, we're doing that at my home. We're ordering more stuff on Amazon. We're getting all, all the pre-delivered food services, which we were doing anyway. This is justification, now for my significant other. She's ordering ordering more overpriced food. But I'm concerned now, the fact that the viability of this virus on cardboard, these Amazon shipments, is it reasonable to put them in a holding area like your garage for a period of time before you bring them into your living environment? The box gets dropped off the truck. Is that safe for you to bring in your home?
I mean, as I say, cardboard looks like it's 24 hours that the virus can stay viable. How likely that is to infect someone is a whole different story, and we just don't know. So I think that's going to be a very personal decision until we get more science. I'm certainly looking at if I don't need the thing that's getting dropped off from the Amazon box. We're in the same situation. Then I'm just leaving it on the doorstep for an extra day or bringing it in carefully and leaving it aside. But I there's only so much that's reasonable. And I don't think we know that those viruses, that's definitely not the main mode of transmission.
Right. And that's the big thing, right? It's the transmission mode, because whether the virus is still viable on a surface is not necessarily, the vector is not necessarily there.
Precisely. It's not necessarily going to infect you. And I think we need to be really careful. I've seen a lot of, oh my goodness, the virus can stay on, kitchen counters for 3 days. Well, yes, but it's infectious, but it's not so infectious that those exposures are likely to get most people. I think most of your transmission is very clearly, face, hand to the next person's hand into their face. It's that very close transmission. And then the next layer is potentially respiratory droplets. And the division between those is absolutely not understood at this point in time. And the potential for transmission and where it's coming from is very poorly understood. So
in the chat box, somebody's mentioning, if that's the case in 24 hours, and why not just take it out of the box, leave the box outside? And I think that makes sense. But then what is a smart way to actually even do that? Are you going to have nitrile gloves on as you're handling the box? I'm as an environmental guy who deals with, sampling and mold and yeast and all that all the time in the environment and bacterium, I'm used to handling things that way. But is general consumer going to be prepared for that, or even have the resources to do that?
Absolutely not. And I mean, at the end of the day, this is where that frequent hand washing with soap and water comes in. That's really what we all need to be doing, is you handle things that somebody else may have handled. That's where washing with soap and water is going to be your best defense. I learned, when I was an undergraduate, I did research in a, nuclear chemistry facility. And so we were working with radionuclides and had very stringent, methods for ensuring that nothing got moved across gloves or across your hand. And my job was to go and test and make sure that all of these surfaces, we weren't moving radionuclides accidentally into the bathroom or down hallways and on door handles. And it's tough. It's tough to use gloves properly. It's really tempting to just wear gloves and then go put them on a surface that's got contamination, but then your initial reaction is probably to go and open your door or turn on the faucet on your sink. And so I think just the best defenses we've got in terms of surface transmission, if you can't wash those surfaces, it's washing your hands.
Hey, Delphine, follow up here too. I know you have to bounce here pretty soon, but did you in your home chem study do anything with ATP meters using adenosine triphosphate swabs on surfaces for cleanliness? Because the question was, is that possible? Will the ATP be able to validate surfaces clean for virus? I'm not sure that.
Yeah, we did some, we worked with some microbiologists who are real experts in microbes in the indoor environment, and they did some of these swabs and a lot of these tests. My understanding is that at this point, it's not clear that they're able to pick up the coronavirus, not at this point, but I mean, I think that's one of those, we'll stay tuned to the research community over the next few days, weeks, months, and start seeing what comes out. But let's see what comes out of research labs out of places like the National Institute of Health, WHO, before going to commercial products at this point. So with that, I think I've got to bounce.
I know.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you guys. Thank you, Joe and Bob, for hosting and organizing all of this.
Thanks.
Follow up. Thanks.
Have a good one.
You too.
So, Joe, we're going to take a break at a certain point here because I've got to prepare for panel number two. But some follow-up stuff while you're here. You and I seem really well-versed with being on camera together. So it seems comfortable. It's like we're next to each other, although we're 2,500 miles apart-ish.
Yeah, well, we were here last night, what time, 2, 3 in the morning or something. So
yeah,
I want you to do me a favor, bring up one slide. It's
which one?
Because I'm slide 6 on the, you know, it's not labeled. Maybe it is labeled.
Slide six is the risk exposure hazard one?
Yes, please.
You got it. Bear with me. And it's the process. There you go.
That's ventilation.
That's not it. Hang on. What's weird is... that's the one I actually clicked. Let me move forward through the slideshow.
No, forward, yes. Keep going.
There
you go. Right. So I put this because we talked about how much time we're in a house. And we at Hayward Score estimate that you're probably in a home around 13 hours a day, you know, giving you time to go to work 8 hours and drive and all that kind of stuff. And you probably do something else. But, and I still give you that you're going to leave your house for an hour to go walk the dog or something, but some people may not. You may do a 24-hour shift. So that's a 77% increase in the amount of time that you're exposed to your existing hazard. So we think there's going to be some significant burdens upon people that they weren't used to. The other one that we didn't get a chance to talk about was that the home used to have a chance to settle. So you got up in the morning, things are very active, particulates are moving, chemicals are happening, and then the home had a chance to kind of rest in general. Right. And now you came home and everything went back to activity, and then everybody went to bed and it went back to rest. So many homes now don't have this chance of actually relaxing or resting or things, particles settling or other conditions going back to a low state of activity. So actually I said many homes are now going to have a high state of activity in terms of particulates and other things that are constantly moving around. Those particulates are what's also grabbing a lot of the stuff you're trying to not breathe. And that's the greatest transmission, is those kind of conditions. So, you know, ventilation and filtration is going to now make a major difference on why 23 hours is going to be a new burden for you in your house.
I mean, and it's not reasonable. Like, you know, many people out there probably have HEPA filtration. They have, you know, they have some high end stuff, but I don't think that's the general public. I don't think that's the case. Do you?
No, not at all. Most people have less than a MERV 8 in their furnace, which isn't operating. Maybe it's operating now because it's still kind of winter conditions for most people. But it's not really designed for that type of capacity, is to removing that. And how often do people change their filters or know they even have a filter? So those are some common challenges. So trying to educate the public on a new condition in their home is going to be dang near impossible. So
to bring your slide back up with your improvised home filtration unit, Bill Turner made a comment, and I think it's a valid one. You do have to be concerned that you overheat the fan motor. So you're going to want to have a box fan that has some sort of a thermal overload protection on it so that you don't end up having a motor go on fire. And
Yeah, I've done this with many different types of filters, one inch.
Okay.
Yeah, and 4 inch, and the 4 inch doesn't seem to have much of a burden on the fan itself. The 1 inch can.
It's going to load up more because you have less surface area.
Yeah, major restriction in terms of pressure that moves through a 1 inch filter. So, but the 4 inch has a lot more availability for airflow. And that's why we recommend making sure you have a control on the top or the side or someplace where you can get to, because if you cover it with the fan, the only way to turn it on or off or adjust it is to plug it in and unplug it. So.
Well, I mean, so what other things in absence of, building your own makeshift air filter? Do you think the recommendation of for a period of time every day opening your windows more than you typically do and flushing your house, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, we do. As well as even something as simple as, opening the window on one part of the house and using your exhaust fan for 15, 20 minutes to do a basic activity of filtration throughout the house. So now I'm actually able to let air come in from below, and if your bathroom's upstairs or whatever the course is, you're trying to get a cross ventilation. It doesn't matter, just open windows. You want to open windows that are on the opposite sides. You can sense that there's a slight air coming. You don't need to open it a lot. Even just a cracked window on both sides of the house or upstairs, downstairs could be very effective. In fact, we've seen this. We've been in homes that are incredibly tight, and we watch carbon dioxide rise to well over 1,000, and then we just crack two windows, and within less than half an hour, they come back to below 600. So those are things that are actually practical solutions for a lot of people. Understanding that you could be letting moisture in, or mm-hmm. you could be changing the temperature, which also impacts your moisture load. So there again,
it's a dynamic situation. That's the problem. Sure is. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I mean, yeah. I always tell people that too. It's like, you always consider when you do something, some form of mitigation, maybe creating new problems, and you really do need to think forward, which is difficult. It's hard. Complexities of building science.
It is. So, again, our goal is trying to find out what is actually changing in people's reactions to their home. So that's one of our goals at Hayward Scores, for people to, get us to work with their clients to try and find out what we can do in this new environment. This isn't just historic. This is actually a new paradigm as to what people are going to experience over the next 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. I mean, it's, certainly, I do fear that it's tip of iceberg. And, just an example, just people from my social sphere who just tend to look at me as, like the Chicken Little, perhaps, they're all out for St. Patrick's Day, filling bars up, getting all in close contact. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I think that's akin to being the people in the ballroom on the Titanic as it slammed the iceberg, dancing and celebrating. I'm looking for the life raft personally.
Yeah, I'm always
proverbial life raft.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Right. Safe and sorry. Right. I don't mind getting wet, but I definitely want to make sure I'm safe.
Yeah. So, the big thing I think is, what can people generally do? I mean, to reiterate, right. Wash your hands.
Soap.
Yeah.
Soap,
and that seems silly, it seems simple, but actually it's effective, and isolating your contact from others, certainly, and limiting when you do have to go out, there's going to be times you have to go out and get, you have to go to, pharmacy and get, your prescriptions filled. You have to get food, and there's things, we have to do. So it's, it's balancing, trying to limit that, right?
It is. And, but what the things that most people forget about is they think you can do one thing and then forget about it. So you need to be a little bit more due diligence about what you're experiencing in the home. And if you're not sure what's going on, step outside and see how different outside is from your indoors, and then try to make some adjustments inside in terms of what you're doing, or, whether you go buy a box fan and a filter or not. So, mm-hmm. I think the problem is we become complacent. I do think that, maintenance is going to go down for a lot of people. It's just going to become, especially for renters. Nobody's coming to your, many people aren't having people come to their buildings to do regular maintenance because of they think it's an exposure risk. So
yeah,
there's a lot of things that we're going to be completely open-eyed about that we forgot could be occurring during this time.
Well, I think a substantial thing to consider, right? Because the service industry, like it's all well and good. You and I do our work remotely anyway. That's not right. I mean, that's you know, something we're accustomed to being online. We're accustomed to, you know, I do online training. You do online training. We, you know, I have a staff.
TimberScore, we meet all the time on this exact venue or a similar one that, you know, this is how we work. It's that just seems of a much more efficient way. We get together maybe two or three times a year just to do things that have to be done in person.
I mean, we have, you know, and for the other publication I'm working with, Building Performance Journal, our staff, the remainder of the staff's all in California. I'm the East Coast guy. So we've actually never met in person from the time I joined the team back in August. We've been, you know, telecommuting, video conferencing since the beginning. You know, so is that the future? I mean, is that, you know, again,
but you know this as well as anybody. The one thing that we've been missing in all of our conferences is that they don't record them. You know, the enormous amount of information that gets, you know, presented by somebody, you can get their slides, but if you don't hear what they're talking about, you miss really the point of why they're on stage. And now they're going to be recording them. Now they're going to actually even present a recording. So there's going to be this great share of knowledge that we've been missing out on for years based upon how we do conferences. So I'm really excited. I know that Maine's indoor energy conference, they do that. They actually record things and you guys post them. That's phenomenal sharing of great information that gets lost in most of these conferences. And I really wish, even if it was low quality, just give us something. Audio with the slides, something. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's, you know, to that point, the IAQ and energy conference is the one you're referring to from the Maine Indoor Air Quality Council. It was held in 2018 and then again last Halloween in November 1st. It's in Portland, Maine. It's a regional event. We at Healthy Indoors partnered with them to make it online virtual streamed event where the people could participate in it remotely. And, you know, we're still honing it, you know, I'll be honest. Yeah. Joe was a presenter at both of those. So you got to experience our pain of trying to live scramble and do multiple live television shows with a small crew. So it has its challenges, but I think we're going to see, I believe, you know, there's going to be more of a push to go that route. I mean, certainly in the short term, I know three industry conferences I'm engaged with right now that had to cancel or postpone and are looking to have at least alternative online offerings to at least cover part of that so their constituents can, you know, get that information, get their continuing ed credits that they need to get to maintain their licenses and certifications. So I think we're going to see more of that. You know, we've kind of been, I think we got early on it with Healthy Indoors and IAQ School Online. We started doing that very thing several years ago. But yeah, I think you're going to see everybody getting into it. Maybe it's going to be, I think many people were resistant to attend events online because of the sterility of them, I think, right? You know, a typical webinar with just voiceover, PowerPoint, kind of boring, right? I have a hard time listening to it. You're dynamic. Okay.
They haven't seen either one of us. So like, if you want to see what really people can
but
do.
But I'm challenged if I don't have video. If I can't go out there and do my video shtick, it's a challenge for me.
I like the chat. I really am promoting that. That's why we try to get a chat going. You know, whenever I used to do those for RetroTech, man, when the chat was full, it was a great webinar. That means people were communicating with each other. It went beyond what I was talking about. It was sharing collectively is the goal of what this should be. It isn't just about you and I and the other panel, blah, blah, blah. And it's like other people collectively, we know more than any of us.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. None of us, you know, our panel was, I think it was great. We've got two more really good panels coming up. For those of you who are still online, numbers wise, we still have quite a few people online. So, you know, thank you for hanging with us. But 3/4 of our audience are a good portion of the state.
They may be online, but I don't know if
they probably ran away. They ran away.
Muted.
But that's fine. We're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes so we can prep and get our second set of panelists in and get ready to run that. But just so you know, so our second session will occur at 1 p.m., Eastern Daylight Time. And that one's going to be titled Managing the Public Health Crisis. So we're going to jump into that a little more, not from the medical side, but, you know, we have participants, Dr. David Krause. You know, he's founder of an organization, Healthcare Consulting and Contracting. But David comes from an occupational health and safety background. He's a PhD, a certified industrial hygienist. He worked in public health in the state of Florida for many years. Also, Scott Armour, who is, again, another internationally known person dealing with public health and indoor environmental conditions. And also we'll have a good friend of mine, Tim Hebert, who works extensively in the healthcare environment, doing indoor environmental work, HVAC hygiene, that sort of thing. Corbett will be back. Joe, you're welcome to continue to participate if you like.
Oh, yeah, you know I'll be back. I'll be in the background. I'll be the chatty guy.
You'll be active as a panelist. Just, you know, you can be there. We'll bring you in there. Well, I'm not going to, you know, or I can pull you in when we do Q&A.
Yeah, but I appreciate what you do for everybody in the industry, and thanks for having me on. But Bob did not really kind of promote that. I got hold of Bob over the weekend when everybody's like, okay, all the conferences are now done. I said, Bob, we need to create a way for people to get access to some great education. So you will see us both back. I would rather moderate sometimes than present. So I will switch roles with Bob, and throughout all of rest of this month and all of next month, you will see a lot more activity on a regular basis. Coach Joanne, some will be open discussion. Some will be, we're going to find some of the people that we want to hear from and let them tell us more about what we don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I will tell you, you can get more information. Those of you that are on this event probably got to healthyindoors.com, but just in case you didn't, we'll put in the URL for that. It's going to be healthyindoors.com. That's their website for our publication, Healthy Indoors Magazine. We have all of our information, videos, articles, all the back issues of the publication archive there. So, you know, hopefully that'll be a repository for credible information. We really do try to vet what we put up there and at least have some reasonable sense of that we're comfortable with that information. We're certainly not up there to just sell things. We're up there to try to promote good information in the industry. And I think now, especially in this ongoing pandemic that we're dealing with, it's uncharted waters. You mentioned that earlier, Joe. This is new territory. In our lifetimes, none of us have experienced anything like this. I deal with outbreaks of mold, outbreaks of bacteria in a given healthcare facility or something like that. But this is a whole different level.
Oh, you know, so I'll leave with one last thought. So sure. It doesn't really impact most people listening as a generation, but for those of you who remember when Osama bin Laden was assassinated, right? There was this major thing that happened across college campuses across the country that they came out in the middle of the night when this thing was announced, and they all were like, yeah, because the psychology was that they were children when this had occurred and that they were traumatized by this figure from all of the news media that we were all just overwhelmingly attached to, right? Mm-hmm. So my question is that what will this do to the use when they become more of adults? Is there a concept now of like hand washing and sanitizing and over-preparedness will impact society, especially as these kids get older? What are the long-term impacts that actually come from this type of trauma for kids who, you know, we can't hardly digest this or understand it, let alone what's going to happen to their concept of the world when they start actually experiencing the world? I think there's going to be something interesting that comes about from what we've done to ourselves.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, I can say in my own life, you know, with and my wife, Christy, I have strove to try to be limiting my carbon footprint for quite some time. You know, I mean, you drive the electric hybrid car, try to recycle as much as you can. And that's another whole story, right, with single stream recycling and how effective that is. And not very, but, you know, we feel like we're doing something. But right now, like, you know, just trying, you know, the fact that we're dealing with provisions and food stores and everything, because we're attempting to really not, you know, and our family to not be out in public. And I'm really concerned. You know, I'm going through a package of organic spinach in the refrigerator that got a little wilty, and I'm picking out the real slimy ones and keeping the rest of it. And there's more than I can eat, so I put it in a Ziploc bag and froze it. You know, it's like things I would never do. That would have just been tossed. You know, but it's like, no, don't throw that old muffin out. You know, it's like, and don't touch the dry goods and the canned goods yet. You know, I'm holding on to that in case stuff really, you know, takes a turn for the worse. And it's a different mindset. I mean, I didn't have that mindset 3 weeks ago, I'll tell you.
No. So, well, I think the goal is that people stay calm, which we know does not happen. And let's see if we can't just do our own. If more people stayed at home, we can beat that. That's why I brought that slide about Singapore and others who did this. And we'd be done by now if we did this 3 weeks ago. Or, well, in theory,
well, I don't know about that. We could flatten the curve, I think.
We could flatten the curve. We will flatten the curve sooner now that this is happening, but we're in it. We're headed up.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Carol off camera just mentioned, you know, it's like my mother's mindset. So my mom was actually born in 1922. Thank you. This is terrible. I can't remember my own mother's birthday. So she was born in 22. So she lived through the Great Depression, you know, and I grew up with grandparents that were actually immigrants through Ellis Island, you know, that whole thing, right? So yeah. I used to think they were crazy when I was a kid in the 70s, or they're saving pieces of string and they're saying, you know, they don't throw that out. And like, and I always used to think you're hoarders. And now I'm like, oh my God, I'm a hoarder now. You know, it's like I'm going there because I'm thinking, hey, these resources are finite. So maybe, I guess my point here is maybe this will serve as a wake up call for us to maybe start turning things around with the whole climate, you know, the climate change thing and how we are continually wasting our limited resources on this planet.
Well, and also be self-dependent, because if we're dependent on somebody else, like we need these and they're made in China and China needs them more than we do, we're not going to get them.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in the next session. So with that, we're gonna keep logged on, okay? But we're going to actually, Joe and I are going to sign off so we can do our potty breaks and get some coffee and do the things we got to do. And I'll be queuing up the next group of presenters.
See everybody. See you.
Yeah, right, exactly. So we'll be back presenting live at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. For Healthy Indoors Magazine, I'm Bob Krell, and this is Joe Medosh, hanging in there tough with me from Hayward Square.
Thanks a lot.
Alrighty.
And now, let me restate what I just stated. To recap what I've been reading to you from my PowerPoint slides.
Huh? Webinars suck. We have a better way. Welcome to IAQschool.online. We're different, and that's a good thing. Hi, I'm Bob Krell. I'm the founder and training director of IAQ School. I've been in the training business in the IAQ industry for over 30 years. Our whole vision behind IAQ School Online was to bring that live classroom experience right to you in your own home or office. We provide live interactive two-way communication between our instructors and the students for a real live classroom learning experience. IAQschool.online is the next best thing to actually being there. Our exclusive distance learning platform creates a live virtual classroom experience where everyone can truly interact. Students see and hear our instructor's live video feed, our instructor sees and hears the students, and the students can even see each other, just like a real classroom. We utilize a variety of virtual hands-on activities to engage our attendees for a unique and highly effective educational experience. We've just raised the bar over the competition's heads. Great content, great instructors, great value, and amazing convenience. That's IAQschool.online. We're not like the other trainers in the IAQ industry, and we don't want to be. IAQschool.online. We bring the classroom to you.